This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
More information can be found at kboo.fm/Inner City Blues Festival 2013.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, BP calls its first witness for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
A bill that would repeal the death penalty in Oregon moves forward in the legislature.
And NASA receives funding to catch an asteroid. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 8th, 2013. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Serena Fong. Efforts to establish statewide universal health care continue to move through the Oregon legislature. The representative from Oregon's 45th District, Michael Dembrow, plans to be on hand to take questions at a public forum tomorrow evening. Dembrow is the sponsor for House Bill 2922, the Affordable Health Care for All Oregon plan. The forum is being held to both inform constituents and garner support for the legislation, which is scheduled for a hearing in Salem next month. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with organizer Camilo Marquez about the event.
Can you tell me what stage of the legislative process this bill is at?
It will have hearings on May 13th. So the bill has been introduced to committee already. I don't know that there have been any markups or amendments or anything like that. Usually the hearings are sort of staged events, and most of the work has been done behind the scenes between the people who have opinions about it. What we do have some information on is that this hearing is an improvement from the last time Representative Dembrow introduce it, because it didn't get a hearing. But the fact that it's receiving a hearing is very positive. That means people have a chance to express their opinions about it.
Can you lay out briefly what HB 2922 does?
It's called a Act for an Affordable Healthcare Plan for All Oregon, which means that under the auspices of the Oregon Health Authority, there will be established a board of nine representatives to govern this body that will be selected by the governor, and they will establish the means for a program of a single payer, which means that there'll be one agency or administration that is responsible for paying all the bills of everybody who needs health care, without any consideration of employment, of prior condition, of age, and of citizenship. It's something that applies to everybody who lives, resides in the states of Oregon. So there's going to be no restriction whatsoever on access to care. So that right now there are 600,000 people who are not covered in the state. These people cannot afford care. Whatever they need, they have to pay out of pocket, and if they can't pay out of pocket, that means they have to suffer. And consequence of that, we know from research, is fatal for a significant number. For every 100,000 people who are not covered, you can expect 100 deaths. So this is a serious thing. I mean, if this were an illness, we'd consider it an epidemic. Something would be done about it. But this is a social and political decision that we allow people to live in this society without having health care.
That was KBOO's Robin Ryan speaking with Camilo Marquez about the efforts to establish universal health care for Oregon. A public forum is being held at 7 p.m. tomorrow evening at St. Andrew Catholic Church on Northeast Alberta.
Two hearings were held last week regarding legislation that will chip away at Measure 11, a 1994 state initiative that established mandatory minimum sentences for certain crimes. House Bill 3194, which was introduced in February, includes 19 proposals aimed at trimming $32 million from the Department of Corrections budget. Lawmakers conceded that some of the crimes proposed for removing the minimum sentence requirements face an uphill political climb, such as first-degree sex abuse. According to the Oregonian newspaper, the Democrats lack 4 votes in the Senate and 6 votes in the House to move the legislation forward. For more on last week's hearings, KBOO's Evan Owen Stively spoke with Shannon White from the Partnership for Safety and Justice.
So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the hearings on House Bill 3194 last week.
Yeah, so last week the Joint Public Safety Committee heard public testimony on House Bill 3194, which, for folks who don't know, is the big public safety reform package that's being considered by the legislature, which I think is a big bill that does a lot of things. But the basic idea is that the bill would create savings through some sentencing and other modest reforms to our criminal justice system and reinvest those savings. Last Wednesday and Friday, when the committee took testimony, there was a huge range of support of people speaking in favor of the bill. And I think it was exciting to see that there was community corrections, there were people who'd been convicted of crime, there were victims of crime, there were business leaders, there were people from human services, people from the faith community, a huge range of folks who came and spoke about the importance of the kind of programs that we know actually make our communities safer. I do think there are certainly people on different sides of the aisle interested in seeing this bill pass. It's also a very tough political issue because, as I'm sure lots of your listeners have seen, these kinds of bills can kind of be reframed in the election cycle and used to make legislators look soft on crime, when in fact I think this bill and other bills that have passed are really set up to make our community safer, and it's very misleading for people to be framed that way, but that doesn't change what happens in our election cycle. So we still have a tough battle ahead, I think, to see this bill pass.
Could you tell us about any other legislation that's in progress to address Measure 11?
I think this is the bill that would primarily address it. As you may know, there are a few modest reforms to some of the lower level Measure 11 offenses. Those are including assault 2, robbery 2, and then sex abuse 1. And it's because those crimes in particular have a wide range of behavior that people can be convicted of. So some of them may be very, very serious crimes, but some of them may be less so. And so the thinking of the Governor's Commission on Public Safety in recommending those reforms is that those are the right kind of cases for a judge to have discretion. So he or she can impose a longer sentence for a more serious crime, but a shorter sentence or maybe a community placement for a less serious crime. So we're having a smarter use of our resources.
And what happens next in this process, particularly with regards to House Bill 3194?
Well, as far as we know right now, that was the last of the public hearings in front of this Joint Committee on Public Safety. Of course, at some point, they'll have to have a work session and decide what to do with the bill. I think they will be having discussions, and I imagine some may be bringing amendments to try and make this bill exactly what each of the legislators on that committee might like to see. I think for us here at Partnership for Safety and Justice, we're an advocacy organization. It will be a time of really making sure that people are getting their voices heard, that this is Oregon's moment now to see public safety reform, and making sure our members and hopefully your listeners are talking to their legislators and asking them to pass House Bill 3194. Part of what's very important to us as an organization that works with people both who've been convicted of crime and victims of crime is that this bill is really about making our communities safe through investing the right resources where they're needed, whether it's for example, someone who's been convicted of crime needing drug treatment or a victim of crime who needs safe shelter. So there'll be reinvestment for victims of crime. We think this is a good balanced approach to public safety in Oregon and hope that it's going to pass this session.
And is there anything else you'd like to add just before we finish up?
I guess the other piece I would say, because it's an important part of our legislative agenda, is that the other thing that this bill addresses is youth who get tried under Measure 11, which some people may not know. Those kids get automatically put into our adult criminal justice system, which is a much harsher penalty and carries an adult felony conviction on their record that can be a real barrier to employment and housing and safe and stable housing. So there is a lot in this bill that we think is smart, that is research-based. It's been almost 20 years since Measure 11 passed. We know a lot more now than we did then, and it's a time and maybe even past time to do these modest changes, both to Measure 11 and actually Measure 57, which is included in the bill as well.
Thank you so much, Shannon.
Okay, thank you.
That was KBOO's Evan Owen Stively speaking with Shannon White from the Partnership for Safety and Justice about legislation to curb Measure 11 mandatory minimum sentences.
Facing a deadline today, a bill that would repeal the death penalty in Oregon is kept alive in the state legislature. Democratic Representative Mitch Greenlick is sponsoring the bill, which he hopes will become a ballot measure so that Oregon voters can decide whether or not the state should continue its practice of capital punishment. Currently, 18 U.S. states do not use the death penalty. According to Democratic Senator Chip Shields, the death penalty costs taxpayers far more than a life in prison sentence. Governor John Kitzhaber has also been a vocal opponent to the practice of capital punishment. In November of 2011, he said, quote, "The death penalty is morally wrong and unjustly administered. In my mind, it is a perversion of justice." The bill, if it moves forward, would replace the death penalty with life in prison sentences without parole. It is now headed to the Rules Committee for continued work.
This week, the Pacific Fishery Management Council is holding a week-long meeting in Portland to create a strategy for protecting the prey fish which provide the basis of Chinook salmon's diet. KBOO's Matt Maddox spoke with Paul Shively from the PEW Charitable Trust about the upcoming meeting.
The Pacific Fishery Management Council is considering adopting their first ever ecosystem plan. The Pew Charitable Trusts is encouraging the council to adopt the plan. Paul Shively is the manager of the Pew Charitable Trust's Pacific Fish Conservation Program.
My name is Paul Shively. I'm with the Pew Charitable Trust, and I work on our Forage Fish campaign. This week, one of the big decisions they're making is whether or not to form what's called a fishery ecosystem plan. And what that would be a guiding document on how to start managing our fisheries through a whole ecosystem-based approach. And what I mean by that is taking into account the role that each species plays with other species. What we're most concerned about this week is making sure that we start paying attention to the forage fish. Let me back up there a little bit. There are two different types of forage fish, those that are managed and those that aren't managed. And when we think of forage fish, the most common ones that people think about are sardines. But there's a whole host of other forage fish out there, fish like sari, sandlance, all the smelts or most of the smelts. Those are all forage fish that the predator species rely on. And right now, if somebody wanted to open up a fishery on sari, there is no regulation after they give their intent to start that. They could begin fishing on that and there'd be no catch limits. There'd be no end to what they could take as long as the fish were there. We're saying let's put these into what's called a fishery management plan so that we can have a control and prevent a problem before it starts. So often we've managed all of our nation's fisheries on more of a crisis type mode and a species by species. So when a species is in trouble or a complex of species, then we can then say, well, let's address this problem. What's beautiful about this plan is that with a fishery ecosystem plan and then moving to start protecting these forage fish, we're actually saying we're going to address this before the sky starts falling, and we're going to get ahead of the curve here. And the Pacific Fishery Management Council deserves a lot of credit for considering this and starting to move forward with the adoption of a fishery ecosystem plan.
These forage fish are not in danger due to human consumption, but rather for their use as a protein commodity.
The demand for protein out of the ocean is increasing dramatically every year. And most of that is going to feed aquaculture, where they reduce this fish into fish pellets. It's used for fish fertilizer. So many uses for hog food, chicken food, fish pellets. If it was a matter of just worrying about human consumption when it comes to forage fish, we wouldn't have that much to worry about. The big concern is just taking all this protein out of the ocean before its value and role in the healthy ecosystem is really accounted for. And that's what we're saying is let's make sure we account for keeping the ecosystem healthy first before we go out and fish these species that we don't know too much about right now to begin with. And if we're going to fish them, let's make sure the science suggests that you can take a reasonable amount out without harming the rest of the ocean.
The vote to adopt the ecosystem plan will take place tomorrow. Paul Shively explains the details of the plan.
Well, tomorrow they're going to be voting on whether or not to adopt what's called a fishery ecosystem plan. And this will be a very visionary document that would then guide how to start managing our fisheries on an ecosystem level approach rather than a species by species. That's very significant because, as a general rule, that's the way the discussion in all of the U.S. waters is beginning to go, is to look at how do you measure the value of a fish in the water as much as in the net. For instance, in the case of the forage fish that we are concerned about, a recent study showed that forage fish are worth twice as much left in the water for their contributions to other species as they are valued in the net. So this plan tomorrow that the Pacific Fishery Management Council is going to be voting to adopt would begin setting the guidelines on how to manage these forage fish that are so important to the entire ecosystem.
More information on the campaign can be found at pewenvironment.org/pacificfish. Oregon members of the Pacific Fishery Management Council can be contacted at pfmc.comments@noaa.gov. This is Matt Maddox with KBOO News.
The neighborhood group fighting a large development project on Southeast Division Street is asking for help with its legal bills. The Richmond Neighbors for Responsible Growth has raked up nearly $5,500 in legal bills fighting against an 81-unit apartment building on Southeast 37th and Division. Last week, the Portland City Council denied the group's request to force the developer into adding on-site parking to the half-completed project. Judah Gold-Merkel, a member of the group, told the Portland Mercury that the City Council was coerced into allowing the parking-free development to proceed based on threats of a lawsuit. Amendments to city code that require parking minimums were passed at last week's city council meeting, but the developer of the Division Street apartment building was allowed to secure a permit before the changes take effect. The Portland City Council is expected to vote the parking amendments into law this Wednesday.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. The night show examines the difficulties of maintaining a relationship while incarcerated. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be warm with intermittent sun and clouds, highs near 60 degrees. Clouds should continue into the evening, lows around 52.
It's 5:20 and time for our daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
One of the finest benefits that our global society derives from having an elite class of super-rich individuals is the priceless advice they offer to the rest of us. For example, America was blessed last year with the special wisdom of Mitt Romney. As he struggled to get traction among the common people for his presidential campaign, he reached out to the youthful spirits who had sparked the Occupy Wall Street protests. In a father knows best tone, Mitt informed them that political anger toward financiers who've achieved financial success is wrong-headed. Rather, he lectured, they should emulate the rich. Take a shot. Go for it. Get an education. Borrow money from your parents, he advised. Lest you think that Romney's perspective is peculiarly American, get an earful of Gina Reinhart. She owns Australia's largest mining empire and is the world's richest woman, holding $30 billion in personal wealth. Last year, she offered this insight on what the riffraff of her country need to do to get ahead. If you're jealous of those with more money, do something to make more money yourself. Spend less time drinking and more time working. Did I mention that Gina got to the top the old-fashioned way? Not by working her way up, but by inheriting her fortune from Daddy Reinhardt. Ironically, while this fabulously rich lady admonishes the laboring masses that harder work is their ticket to more money, she's campaigned aggressively to slash Australia's minimum wage. How low would she go? Speaking to her peers at the posh Sydney Mining Club, Reinhardt expressed fondness for the African model. Africans want to work, she explained, and its workers are willing to work for less than $2 a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, such social and economic perceptiveness is why Gina, Mitt, and their ilk are so appreciated by the world's workaday people.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The first witness for BP took the stands at a trial today in New Orleans, testifying that the oil giant drilled its Macondo well safely before a series of mistakes led to the worst offshore oil spill in U.S. history. Retired LSU petroleum engineering professor Adam Burgoyne, a noted expert in drilling operations, stated that crew members and BP supervisors followed normal industry practices. His disagreement was mainly with the conclusions of Alan Huffman, an expert witness for the federal government who testified earlier in the trial. Huffman accused BP of deviating from industry standards, concluding that the company repeatedly failed to operate within a safe drilling margin, which he defined as the cushion between the well's mud weight and its fracture gradient. The mud weight must be kept heavy enough to keep fluids from flowing up the well without fracturing the formation that is being drilled. Failing to maintain this way of drilling, according to Huffman, presented extreme danger to the men and women aboard the Deepwater Horizon, a point upon which Burgoyne disagrees. He claims that the drilling margin allegations had no connection to the blowout. Despite earlier disagreements, Burgoyne did concur with the majority of investigators in concluding that crew members failed to properly monitor the well and rig supervisors misinterpreted a key safety test just before the blowout. Burgoyne commented that BP supervisors and crew members employed by rig owner Transocean Ltd. discussed the test results as a group and ultimately bought into the alternate explanation for abnormal drill pipe pressure, quoting that they had a lot of confidence in one another, and once they made the decision, they were convinced they were right. Plaintiff's attorney Jim Roy asked Burgoyne if a moron ought to know whether the test is a success based upon the pressure readings. No comment, replied Burgoyne, who later added, I think in general, this crew was competent and had the appropriate training. Why they made this mistake, you can't explain it. U.S. District Judge Colin Barbier is hearing testimony without a jury. Barring a settlement, he could decide how much more money BP and its contractors owe for their roles in the catastrophe. Testimony by BP witnesses is expected to last at least 2 weeks.
NASA's plan to catch an asteroid now has the funding to become a reality. President Obama's proposed budget for the next fiscal year includes roughly $100 million to get the project off the ground. Some of these initial funds would be used to identify potential asteroids to capture. In 2011, a team of scientists at the California Institute of Technology published a study that minimizes the risk and cost of an asteroid capture mission. The study proposes the robotic capture of an asteroid approximately 23 feet in diameter. The asteroid would then be placed in orbit around the moon and be studied by manned missions. The captured asteroid could be used to research techniques for deflecting asteroids from a collision course with Earth, develop technologies for trips to Mars and other deep space explorations, and develop space mining technology. According to Florida Senator Bill Nelson's office, NASA's plans would have astronauts on the asteroid by 2021. The mission could launch as early as 2017.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, 11 women and children were killed during a NATO-led attack on militants this weekend. NATO has not accepted responsibility for the deaths, which occurred amidst fighting in the Kunar province near the Pakistani border. In the southern province of Zabul, a car bomb killed 5 Americans this weekend, including 3 U.S. soldiers, a young diplomat, and a U.S. Defense Department contractor. Today, an end bomb exploded on a bus traveling southwest of Kabul, wounding 22 people. The Interior Ministry holds the Taliban responsible, though a spokesperson for the insurgents strongly denies involvement in the attack.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, April 8, 2013. Two Palestinian civilians injured by Israeli troops' gunfire and soldiers attack an anti-wall and settlement protest. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A journalist and a Palestinian worker were reported injured on Monday by Israeli army gunfire in two separate incidents in the West Bank. Muhammad Al-Azza, 23 years old, a photojournalist, was hit in the face as he was covering clashes between invading Israeli soldiers and Palestinian youth at Aida refugee camp in the southernmost bank city of Bethlehem on Monday afternoon. Medical sources said that Muhammad were moved to a nearby hospital in critical conditions after one of the Israeli soldiers shot him in the face with a rubber-coated steel bullet. Many others were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Meanwhile, a Palestinian worker was shot and injured by Israeli troops' live gunfire near the northern West Bank city of Nablus on Monday evening. The man was injured when Israeli troops opened fire at a group of Palestinian workers working at a construction site just outside Nablus city. The army gave no reason for shooting at the workers. Earlier on Monday morning, Israeli troops attacked a nonviolent protest organized by villagers and their international and Israeli supporters at the village of Beit Umar, southern West Bank. Residents were protesting the Israeli wall and settlements built on lands stolen by the Israeli army from local farmers. Soldiers used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to attack the unarmed protesters. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Moreover, one international supporter was arrested by the Israeli army during the protest. On Monday at dawn, two residents were kidnapped by Israeli troops who invaded the village of Sorif, also southern West Bank. Residents announced that troops invaded the village, searched homes, and then took the two men away without giving any reasons. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, April 8th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassam Kassis and me, Ghassam Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Evan Owen Stively, John Rasmussen, and Matt Maddox. The producer is Serena Fong. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, that's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris.
At 9 on Alternative Radio, former U.S. Representative Dennis Kucinich speaks on war and peace. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
And at 11, D-May Roberts hosts Stage and Studio, featuring an in-depth and intimate talk with author Cheryl Strayed, the author of Wild. At 11:30 on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan interviews painter Seth Tain, a realist painter who depicts industrial maritime scenes, as well as street scenes from San Francisco and New York. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our spring membership drive. Thank you to all who pledged to keep KBOO strong.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, John.
Good night, Serena.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 8th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, WikiLeaks releases a database of nearly 2 million U.S. diplomatic documents. It's the group's largest publication to date. Protests against the U.S. targeted killing program continue as activists and faith groups highlight the CEOs and companies profiting from drone manufacturing. And we'll go to Bolivia, where violent attacks on women have sparked protests and legislative action. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Margaret Thatcher, Britain's longest-serving prime minister of the 20th century, died today. President Obama paid tribute, saying, quote, "America has lost a true friend." Her hardline approach earned her a nickname, the Iron Lady, but it also garnered numerous critics. In 1980, she famously declared,
"You turn if you want to. The lady's not for turning."
In 1981, she refused to negotiate with hunger-striking Irish Republican prisoners who wanted to be recognized as political prisoners. The hunger strike ended only after 10 prisoners starved to death. Abroad, her belligerent approach was evident when she ordered military action to retake the tiny British territory of the Falkland Islands. In 1982, Argentina invaded the islands in the South Atlantic. Nearly 800 soldiers from both sides died. Many political analysts say Thatcher is the force that shifted British politics to the right. Current Prime Minister David Cameron continues many of the policies she introduced. During her 11 years in office, she oversaw widespread privatization of state-run services and fought bitter battles to weaken British trade unions. Riots over what became known as a poll tax were part of what hastened her exit from office. Margaret Thatcher died following a stroke. She was 87. There's no official word from NATO yet on reports that 11 Afghan children were killed in an ISAF airstrike.